Welcome to Perspectives on Prevention, the podcast series from the Prevention and Early Intervention Network, where we talk with people about intervening early and preventing difficulties arising for children, families, and communities. In this episode of Perspectives on Prevention, I talk with Ahmed Hassan about working with people in the asylum process, the direct provision system, and how we can offset some of its negative impacts. So welcome to Perspectives on Prevention, the podcast series from the Prevention and Early Intervention Network. And in this episode, I'm joined by Ahmed Hassan, who has been working with Doris in Limerick for the last 7 years in a number of different capacities, Doris being a very well-established NGO working with asylum seekers in Limerick and the surrounding community. So in that time, Ahmed has been working, he's worked with the Syrian refugees as a resettlement worker. He's done a lot of work supporting people transitioning in and out of direct provision. And currently he's a community sponsorship worker with Doris, but really very significant experience of working with asylum seekers. So you're very welcome, Ahmed. Lovely to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you, Marian.
So Ahmed, we could, of course, spend quite a bit of time debating, you know, what's going on in the world that is creating the level of global migration that we're seeing. And we could also spend considerable time talking about all the woes of the direct provision system and, you know, the sort of, you know, all the things that we know are so problematic in that system. But I think given the listeners that we have and the membership of the Prevention and Early Intervention Network, what I'd really like to focus on with you is from your really considerable experience of working closely with people in the asylum process and particularly those living in direct provision, or as it's now called, IPAS, the International Protection Accommodation Service. What supports could be in place? What would help families to, I suppose, offset some of those difficulties that arise from living in direct provision, particularly for considerable lengths of time? So that's the area I'd really like to focus on. So maybe we'll start, Ahmed, with you just telling us a bit about sort of your observations over the years of, you know, the issues and the difficulties that you have seen in those who live in direct provision, particularly families, so particularly those who are there with children. So what are the things that, you know, that have recurred for you in your observations?
So thank you very much. And it's something that it's an issue that has been going on for a period of time, and a lot of recommendations have been made. And most of the time, as you say, it has a dire effect with most of the families that are living in direct provision, especially in terms of development stages for children and in terms of their growth development, in terms of their own mental health situation within the context of being in DP centers. First and foremost, most of the kids that are in DP centers, they're not able to invite friends into the centers. They're not able even to have sufficient spaces to do their homework, some of them during a period of time. And also in terms of privacy, as in most of the contexts, a whole family would be put in the same room and age difference in terms of growing up with your sisters, your brother. So all those things align and most of the time create a problem. But the families in the context of the situation, because they're seeking asylum, there's no anywhere around it, they have to maneuver and find, be resourceful in most of the situation. So bear in mind in terms of the waiting times, how long is that period that you're waiting for to get a decision from the department? So if it is a short term, those who are lucky, that is a short term, maybe a year and a half or 2 years, but still there's long-term effects on the health and well-being of the children and the family as a unit, in terms of navigating different situations, in terms of as a parent, you're not able to show your own capabilities, because some people coming in, they might have been affluent in their background, having a job, having everything, and they lost everything. So now you're not being able to show your children as a breadwinner, as a father, the meals at designated times. Then even if you want to kind of do other extra to cook for, it's not possible. So there has been changes in some sort of the word and also the structural, but still in terms of the whole dynamic of a family, they're still being affected with other issues that, as I said, they might look mundane to people, but just having your own privacy is very important for anybody, even for adults as parents. They don't have that. And imagine your kids are there, you're all shacked together in the same room. So it is a very important kind of for children to see that they don't have their own space. They have their own way of doing things if they're also able to invite their friends, because they're making connections in schools outside the scope of the direct provision. They're being invited themselves to stay over with their friends' families. They go, but they feel sometimes they don't want to engage in that because they are not able to extend the same courtesy that they're being given. And that, you can imagine, has a detrimental effect on children and families. As parents also suffer the same consequences because their kids keep asking, when will we move? When will we have that opportunity or capability of us also inviting our friends over?
Ahmed, you mentioned that, you know, if you're lucky, you might get your, you know, decision in a year or a year and a half. I mean, of families that you're working with and have maybe been working with for some time, I mean, what kind of length are families staying in direct provision centres?
Some up to 5, some up to 7 years. So, as I said, the lucky ones would be minimum 18 months to 2 years. That they're the lucky ones that they will get that decision. But that 2 years has a detrimental effect on the lifestyle, as I said, with children, because children are like sponges. They pick everything they see, what they learn. And in congregated setting, you cannot separate all those situations, because even as a parent, in terms of raising children, you have your own standard. There are simple things that you want your kids to be in a certain way, but when you, it's not possible even to do those things, because they're out of your way. It's not possible.
You know, for those people who've never been in a direct provision centre, can you just explain like what the congregated living looks like and what the, you know, what families can and can't do on a day-to-day basis?
So in terms of most of the congregated setting, I would say in terms of families, you are people from different background, different country of origin, different parental skills, different language, cultural difference. So all those things, even in an estate, at least you have your own house, you can manage that. But when you're in a congregated setting, it's all things are set in time. Your meals, your breakfast, your lunch, your dinner. So you are all kind of congregating together to get your meals. And sometimes, as in this situation, some of the children and the parents would like to give extra to the children, but they're not able from what they're earning. And even the cooking facilities are not to stand in terms of to allow you to do whatever you wish, you know, so it's a bit restrictive. So and then being in a congregated settings, everybody is rushing for the same space. And then there's a difference in terms of how people interact. So it creates a lot of clashes in different situations in terms of who has to take the time to cook. There's no timetable in terms of if the space is available for a particular time, somebody else is doing their own thing. So that clash of personalities, clash of ideas, cultural difference and all, and maybe the same utensils you're using there, somebody who is Muslim, you're a Christian, you cook pork and somebody wants to. So all those things in congregated setting, they create other layers of additional problem, let alone just having the same space whereby in your own room, which is a small and you're not allowed to do anything, a room 4x8, you're not allowed to even boil water in those rooms. So all that situation exacerbates the time length. If the longer you stay there, psychologically, eventually it takes a toll on you. As a parent, yeah. As children, it takes a toll.
So what, I mean, have you observed interventions and supports that help families, that help children and their parents to to get through that time with us, you know, to minimize the sort of negative impacts?
Yeah, so some of the kind of now with recent changes in terms of even allowing the parents the right to work, that now asylum seekers are after 6 months period you're in the States, you're allowed to work. It has kind of negated that the aspect of feeling I'm not able to kind of manifest several things. If you're allowed to work, you're able to buy your own other resources, you're able to give your children other extra support that you wish to. And also in terms of those, while they're waiting in the period of 6 months before they have a right to work, we'll also advise some of them to join homework clubs for the children, so they have also space outside there, they're building friendship with other people. For the parents also, we'll advise some of them to volunteer with different organizations so that they occupy their time. They don't, because you cannot be staying 24 hours in the same center. It's not viable for anybody. So by just having a few activities here and there, there's a lot of free activities, because most of the time, you know, most of the things to do needs money. And what people are paid in direct provision isn't, won't suffice to be joining a gym. So we usually advise those free activities for them to kind of partake in different organizations that they're offering. Maybe it's an evening walk or a men's shed or a bike club or any of the activity that they have. Also the mental conscious aspect of their cognitive being utilized out of the scope of being in direct provision. And they also create a chance for them to build the relationship. And in future, in terms of if they're looking for reference, they'll have friends and social connection they build from that by joining different like Tidy Towns group. Yeah.
And for the children, how easy is that? I'm conscious that, so I worked in the reception and integration agency going back some time ago, and you know, quite a few of the DP centres, they're not based in the city. I mean, even like Knock Machine, which should be one of the areas, you know, one of the centres in your area, is a bit out of town. And so children staying in school for after school activities, I don't know what the transport's like. So just those kind of, you know, practical issues. What's that like for families?
Yeah, so most of the, as you said, Noclashin is a bit out of the way, and some of them. So for kids, most of the time, we have kind of advised them to also join the Limerick Youth Service, which is nearby on the north side. It's nearby to Noclashin, so it's even a walking distance for them to have at least activities with the youth club, or there's the Foroga that they have. So something for them also to build their network for the children to keep them occupied. And also there is space provided in those areas for them to do homework. There's homework clubs that volunteer teachers help them with. So it's kind of giving them the space and the scope to be children. Because once they go back to the center, it just kind of, it's not easy, the situation being confined in the same room, that you are all fighting for the small space within a room that can't fit even two or three, and you might be five of you in that room.
I'm very conscious, you know, listening to you, Ahmed, of how there are similarities in what you describe for families in the asylum process to the experience of lots of families who are homeless for other, you know, other reasons, people who are living in family hubs or hotel accommodation. One of the things I've heard public health nurses talking about is that children in homeless accommodation, small children in homeless accommodation for any length of time, can often, that she can tell, because their muscle development isn't happening in the way you would expect, because they have nowhere to walk, crawl, run, and, you know, use their muscles. So their muscle tone is not what you would expect for their age. You said at the outset that, you know, one of the difficulties or one of the impacts on young children is their development and growth. Is that something that you think, you know, that you would have seen as well for young children, that they're not getting the opportunity to kind of run around and in the way that, you know, we would expect children to do?
Yeah, because as you say, being in a center, most of the direct provision, the responsibility is with the parent, because it's a mixed place. Most of the time in the centers, there's older men and all that. So the role of, in terms of looking after your children, it's you as a parent. So you confine them within the remit that you can observe. And that also could tell in terms of growth, as I said, because culturally, if it is your own space, it's you make the rules and decide. But within the direct provision center, it's a total different situation. So within the scope of that child wanting to go out and play, there's the issue of health and safety. There's an issue of welfare. There's issues. So because it's not just an issue of you letting your children to go and play with other children. There's a lot of, and most of the things that we see sometimes, parents are avoiding conflict within children, like normal children, because it escalates to parents and then something else happened. And this also kind of build up with children starting acting up in schools and all that. So it's that confusion that they're not able to develop mentally in terms of being children to be allowed, because when I go back home, I'm not allowed out. I'm allowed to stay in the room while I want to be out because I see other children are out and playing. So, but the parents are doing that to avoid creating conflict and creating situation with, if the children are out playing, they children always argue, sometimes fight. This is your bike. This, it's not my bike. Can we share? Then push each other, escalate to something else. So to avoid the whole situation, most of the parents would prefer to lock their children in their rooms, which is, as I said, it's a tiny room, which is not healthy for any child.
What are the sort of possible solutions to that? I mean, so let's take it as a given that direct provision is going to be hit with us for another while yet, despite, you know, government assurances that it, you know, to the contrary. But we know the pressures on accommodation, so I think it's unlikely that we'll see any change in that anytime soon. So assuming that it's with us for a while, how can the centre managers and the people living in direct provision centres, how can we improve that kind of level of tension and that comes from the cultural differences and the mix of ethnicities? Are there things that could be done to make that easier for people?
Most of the direct provision are not family-centered. They're not. They're just centers that it's a transition place. It's centers that most of, as I said, from I've visited plenty of direct provision. They're not child-friendly in some sense, in some situation, as I said, because due to the lack of numbers, some families, they're given their own space, but there's other people that within that center. It's not that this is only family unit only in terms of, so if it is only families, then it makes it more easier because you can align, you can design, you can even have simple things, games for children to play and other things. But when you have adults within that scope, people from different origin background, as a parent, you'll be worried because you don't know if you let your children out there, who are they meeting? Who are they talking? Because you don't know those people. If, as you said, if the direct provision continue for the next foreseeable future, if they make certain centers as family friendly, or in terms of they should be child centered in terms of having the welfare and well-being of a child and even having the space. I know some of the centers have space for the children to do their homework. That's fair enough in terms of, but then it comes to the issue of supervision, teachers, all those issues come into play. Then in terms of they have some playground, but in terms of the essence of the playground that they have, it's one fit all, that all everybody. So simple things can be played around and just make it easier for children. They don't feel that period that they're in those centers, it's any different with any other child in the mainstream communities, you know?
Yeah. Are there other sort of, you know, obvious things that could be done, Ahmed, that you kind of, you've been banging on about for the last 7 years, that saying, why don't they do this? And nobody's listening. What are the other solutions that you think could make life a bit easier for people?
In any context, in terms of having the conversation, that it's a two-way. As I said, most of the centers, if there's models out there in other countries that in most of the direct provision center, they'll have a psychologist, they have counselors, they have play therapists for children. So having such things within different centers, it enabled in terms of manifesting in terms of the well-being of the children, even having tutor in terms of those support classes for children. Because as I said, there is option that the classes they have, but if these children don't even have the language and some of them miss class for a period of time, then they arrive in Ireland, they're expected to sit in class. And then who is helping them? Because if you don't understand, even Irish kids who were born and raised here, they get extra grinds. So imagine for a child who missed school for 5-6 years, and you find yourself in a secondary school. You have so many subjects. First, to understand even the language is a problem, let alone understand the curriculum, you know? So all those nuances sometimes play a role. And as I said, in other countries where they have managing centers to have maybe 5 or 6 kind of support workers that will be assigned to families in their needs, in terms of looking at their needs from their psychological well-being, from the social, economic, spiritual aspect of things, just to make them feel in terms of, because that also helps at the end in integration of people. If you feel you have the support and whatever trauma you've gone through and you're given the level of support, it's easier to transition, because once you have the grasp of the language, once you know the support, the referral mechanism and how it works, then lo and behold, everything comes. Even if you're there for 2, 3 years, 4 years, at least you'll have the grasp of the whole system, because you find some people are in the direct provision for a period of time. But even when they're leaving, they need people to kind of even the simple transition from moving from those centers to the mainstream situation. Mm-hmm. It becomes a complex, because sometimes some people, when you spend a long time, you become institutionalized.
Of course, yeah,
And people end up even getting into debt when they move from the direct provision, because it was so designed in a way, in terms of everything is planned in a certain way, that you're not, it's not enabling that person to be able to run their lives. So when they get their status, then it's like, again, I have to reformulate the mind of a person in terms of this needs to be this, because you are not able to do those things. But with the right to work, we kind of, it has changed in some sense of the word for those who arrived the last 2 years, but there are people who are there before who were not even able to access that right to work. And there have been Ireland, some of them, 4 years previous to that law coming into effect. So they're in the same predicament. They're still in the DP center. They don't even have right to work. They're still waiting for their status, you know. So
okay.
Yeah.
Again, I'm really struck by the similarities with families living in homelessness, that issue of, you know, becoming institutionalized, becoming de-skilled. You know, I chair a committee for the SIPSI in South Dublin, and, you know, we hear from the local authority about families who've been in a family hub or in a hotel accommodation for a long period of time. When they do eventually get housed, quite often they really run into difficulty very quickly with budgeting, because they haven't been used to paying bills, and actually a little bit of case management, a little bit of support, but a hand holding, as you say, through that transition can make all the difference. You know, it's really interesting hearing those sort of similarities. I want to just go back and talk a bit about trauma, because you've mentioned that, and even, you know, in referencing models in other countries where they have psychologists on site, or, you know, caseworkers, whatever. And so, you know, you're talking about how the system and the sort of facility that these families are living in is so not child friendly, not child centered. But actually, we also have to remember that, you know, most, if not all of these families, you know, they're here for a reason. They fled and sought asylum for a reason. And so could you just say a little bit about the kind of the trauma that you've observed, or what that looks like for people, I suppose?
So in terms of, I can't pigeonhole into, because most of the families they have, country of origin plays a role with the situation where they're from, and also in terms of different dynamics, how they have traveled from the country of origin to arriving in Ireland, as you said. So you can imagine for a person having traveled through different countries with children also, and experienced the different difficulties that they go through, and also from going back in terms of their own country of origin, what happened for them to leave that country. So it's a mixed bag of so many things. And then they have arrived in this country thinking I'm in a safe place and all that. Then it hits you home that you haven't processed what you have gone through. So the parents are trying to process that themselves. The children are trying to process, but children are very resilient. Children are very good in kind of putting aside those thoughts and motor on if they're in school because they're busy the whole day. But the parents are the ones sometimes who kind of are processing those thoughts and how to kind of align themselves that they're in a safe place and who they have left behind. And sometimes it takes a toll on the children because they see what's going on with their parents and they don't understand and how to help. And that's why I was saying to you that it helps sometimes some people from certain country of origin, they're not willing to kind of seek for help. Mental health isn't something that it's on the front line in terms of people wanting to say, oh, I'm struggling. No, they'll find resolve within their own community sometimes, within themselves, until a situation whereby they know, yeah, I need a professional help, then probably unwilling, they'll start the journey. So the issue kind of varies depending, as I said, with the country of origin, with the background also, in terms of the professional, because some of the, even the trauma, some of the people who are working in affluent background, there's a loss of a position of power, position of privilege, position of having everything. And then you arrive in a country now, you're kind of referred to as an asylum seeker, as a refugee, like you're not a human being anymore. Imagine for a person who had it all, and then lo and behold, an example like we'll use Ukraine, people who had everything, then lo and behold, something happened. They had to move. And then arriving here, now you're kind of asking, it's like you're begging some of the things and also navigating the whole structure of the system. That it's frustrating in itself sometimes to navigate the whole system, and you feel, for ourselves, it's like we like to empower people to feel this, they are able, but it is disempowering in so many levels for most of those, as I said, who were okay, they were able to provide for their kids, and then they're in this situation. Psychologically, it takes a toll. And that toll, sometimes it impacts the whole family unit, not only the father and the mother, but also the children sometimes.
And can you say a little bit about any observations you've had of that? How, of course it makes complete sense that if parents are struggling with, you know, really significant trauma, awful experiences, that they, you know, that will impact on their ability to parent and to engage. But is there anything that you can say about what you've observed, or, you know, how that impacts on the children?
So most of the time, how it impacts, as I said, there have been instances whereby the situation where kids missing school because the parents themselves, sometimes they feel, you know what, I've tried my level best, but I'm seeing we are not coping, and we have been dehumanized in some sense of the situation, because sometimes there's a waiting list, even if those who are willing to engage with the services, mental, there is a waiting. When you're on a medical card, there is a waiting list. So lo and behold, you're asking for help. You really want to kind of engage and find solution. Then you're told there is a list. There's a 6 months, 5 months, or 8 months waiting list. How does that help a person who needs help now? Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the effect that sometimes it's frustrating even for us. An example, let's say even like the only specialist in Ireland for torture and trauma is Esperazi, and it has a long waiting list. If somebody is struggling at this moment, the only thing that we can do is refer them to the GP. GP will refer them to the hospital, but the specialized services that they need isn't the one in the hospital that, you know, the hospital themselves will refer them to such service like Esperazi, or lo and behold, those who have the money will go and pay for a private, because they are really struggling and they need solutions, you know. In a nutshell, as I said, children see their parents when they're struggling in those situations. And it end up taking a toll on them in school and also home. So this the spiral keeps continue that way. the first and foremost, I'd say if you're putting families, they should be having centers just for families only, not mixed settings, families. And so that will also make it easier to manage. And also you're looking at the welfare of children. And if it is centers just for adults and male or female adults, should be different also in terms. That's what I'm saying. We don't want to repeat what has already been said, but those are the things that you would envision in a best setting that would make it easier for transition for anybody who arrives in Ireland, especially most of the time for families. If having the support of two or three, either an educational officer for children in terms of a youth worker, a psychologist or a counselor, makes it also easier. Just to kind of check in with the family, their well-being and the well-being of the children, it makes it easier. Those are the main thing I would say if we have an ideal scenario. In the context of the whole Ukraine situation, it's a sad situation in terms of, but there was a lot of goodwill coming from what happened in terms of the support from the Irish public in terms of in our area, because in some way we saw the change in terms of perspective, in terms of awareness, in terms of people understanding that this can happen to anybody, even though we have been singing this for a long time, that anybody can be a refugee anytime. In the beginning, as you said, that the context of understanding the whole situation of refugees changed the landscape in a big way. And we saw even people pledging their homes to host the Ukrainians and the numbers and all this. And for us, it was a kind of a wake up and a good news in terms of the lay of the land was changing. We don't have to quash rumors. We don't have to. It was kind of in a good way. But then it took a sudden turn because, as you said, nobody expected the numbers that arrived in Ireland from Ukraine, because I think that's one of the biggest numbers that arrived in a short period of time in Irish history, if I'm not mistaken. So the public awareness in terms of people who are getting news from snippets, and this is the issue for ourselves sometimes, is people are not have the full information, the ins and outs, who is arriving in their area. And that also makes a massive difference, because for even ourselves, we were doing information session in terms of for those who wanted to host Ukrainians, so that people are aware who are coming to their area, what can they do, how can they support and all. And the bottom line, it all comes down to communication. And sometimes I don't blame the government. Sometimes they make the decision and it affects a lot of people on the ground where that the families will be best. It's availability of space. So for the Ukrainian situation, the government were picking any space that was available, and people were kind of now, certain communities were like, well, the numbers have just increased all of a sudden. Where are these people, even though we know what's going on in Ukraine? So it put pressure on different communities in different areas in terms of if a place that had maybe 1,000 people, then you have 2,000 Ukrainians turning up, you've overhauled the whole town. So then there was no communication. Sometimes that's the problem. But if there was communication, it just makes. So our role sometimes was just to kind of do those information sessions and make people understand. But it isn't the role of NGO to do that. It is the role of the government to work with the local authority, to work with the community leaders, to work with the local development companies, just to raise that awareness. But it's like an egg and a chicken. It's just kind of done, and then you guys do make do of the situation and, you know, just make people aware. So it was, in a way, it helped, but it has changed. It has taken a drastic turn at the moment with all the backlash, with all people enough and all this situation. And the problem of homeless and the situation has been in Ireland since I've been here. It's not that something it has happened, but sometimes people realize the numbers that arrived would curtail in terms of those who are in a homeless situation, who are willing even to look for themselves the housing, as you said, even with people in DP centers who are trying to transition. The rents have gone up because people can't afford. So it's a catch-22 question, the situation. So it's balancing the narrative, because that's the best thing at home. How do you balance the narrative? Because you don't blame people who are seeking asylum or refugees from Ukraine who has temporary directive. If you want to, if you have an issue, discuss it with your local representative, discuss with the government, have your opinion listened, rather than ambushing people who are innocent, some of them. They're just looking for a safe place. they're looking for a better future for their children and all that. So yeah, it's just a mixed bag, to be honest with you.
So how has that changed your job and your, you know, how you are perceived, Ahmed? Has it made your role a more complicated one, or what's that been like for you?
Our roles have been always complicated, because we always have that objection that what are you doing also for the locals? What are you doing, and how are you enabling people while the other people that are coming in, they're getting A, B, C, D? So it's like dispelling the myth and saying they're not getting what you're thinking. They're not being given this. They're not given. In that context, our role with the Ukrainian situation kind of, it gave the scope and awareness, and also in terms of, because it started from the government itself, because there was an awareness from the government in terms of providing the resources, providing information. There was kind of in every region, most of the time they had the Ukrainian forum, kind of committee forum, to kind of help working together, from the ETBs to the guards to the HSE. So it was a concerted effort with everybody, started from the top. And that's where the difference is with the two-tier system. With asylum seekers, it's not the same. That's where, for us, at the moment, we are kind of, if Ireland was able to do all this for almost 50 plus thousand people, what is the problem with doing it for asylum seekers who are maybe 5,000, 6,000, some of them, you know? It's just kind of raise the awareness, but also in terms of make for us, we can push further, that the changes can happen. That's the only part that I'll say, that if they were able to overhaul the whole system to accommodate 50,000, they can also do it with 5,000 people.
So, Ahmed, thank you so much for your time. It's been really great to listen to you and talk with you and hear about some of your reflections and observations of the work that you've been doing there in Limerick for a number of years. So thank you very much for joining us.
No problem, Marianne. It was a pleasure, and talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to Perspectives on Prevention. We hope we've inspired you and given you something to think about. If you want to suggest someone for us to chat with, we'd love to hear from you. Just drop us an email at info@pein.ie.